As constitutions go, America's is the most famous and revered document all around the world. People know some of its words from the very first three, We the People, even through to amendments like the first that guarantees freedom of speech and the second that has the controversial right to bear arms. In that context, I think it's fair to say that the Australian Constitution doesn't inspire as much and is of less interest to citizens in this country, but two brave lawyers have taken upon themselves the task of promoting awareness about the Australian Constitution, the document and the constitutional system that surrounds it, with a new book that former Chief Justice and Sunday Extra guest Robert French says is a comprehensive and readable explanation of the Constitution of Australia's history and its working. Rosalind Dixon is Anthony Mason Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales and co-author, along with William Partlett, of The People's Guide to the Australian Constitution. Professor Dixon, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Julian, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, look, the Australian Constitution may not inspire that much passion today, but I was interested to read in your book that after a bit of a false start, it was created as the result of a grassroots civic movement. Could you tell us about the origins of our Constitution?
Well, I think one has to be fair and say it's not entirely a civics uprising. It had a lot of British imperial influence and, you know, we have got a lot of work to do to fully make it our own. But we really want people to see that it is something to be proud of as well as to keep working on improving, partly because there was this movement called the Chartist Movement in the UK, which basically failed there but had a lot of success in shaping our constitutional tradition, which was people-driven, close ties to the union movement, was involved in the Eureka Stockade. They believed in short parliamentary terms, broad access to the franchise, albeit at that time, you know, men and in racist ways, but broad access, short terms, elections of the Senate, which were kind of, you know, world-leading at the time. So we have really, you know, important and unique democratic origins that we should be proud of and try and recover.
Yes, Australia's system has been described as a Washminster system. Could you explain for us what that term means and what aspects of the system that's referring to?
Well, Elaine Thompson coined that term, and it's a great way of capturing the fact that we were basically a British colony and we took responsible parliamentary government and the common law and a whole bunch of other things from Westminster or London in creating the Constitution. But we were also really influenced by the US and its tradition of the separation of powers and federalism. And so we created this really interesting, unique hybrid. It came to sort of, you know, conflict in the dismissal, but for the most part, it saved, you know, a lot of positive things. It has served us really well. And it's quite unique in the mix between entrenched, rigid federalism, separation of powers that comes from the US, and flexible, politically driven, parliamentary and people driven government that we think you can, you know, trace back to the UK and Westminster.
I was surprised to read in your book that Australia has the first parliamentary system to have a directly elected upper house. I had to double check that that was right. Could you tell us how that is the case? And I suppose,
did ChatGPT agree with us?
It does indeed for the moment. Good. So yeah, good to know we're confirmed, because I was thinking, oh, surely the American Senate, but apparently that was appointed by
governors.
Yeah, state legislatures and the like. Until and so that means that the Senate was a world first. And you really do speak a lot about the Senate and its unique role in our constitutional system. Could you elaborate on that a little bit for us now?
It's just to try and see that Chartist influence, and that, you know, when the people came together to write our constitution, they had to pass the constitution through a British enactment in London, but they had a real sensibility which was about forging a new path, a path where Australian voters had a really central role. And, you know, we have an incredibly long-standing constitution. The average constitution around the world lasts 19 years. Ours has been going strong for 125, but it's not a rigid, you know, a remote document that has nothing to do with us. We actually play a really central role in it through voting, through advocacy, and that's reflected in that Senate innovation that you saw in the 1890s. It's really quite remarkable of its time. The 1890s also saw us preserve women's access to the franchise, which was there in South Australia and which the Commonwealth agreed to preserve as part of the transition. So we did some pretty radical stuff in writing the Constitution, as well as failing to grapple with racism and our First Nations' very significant existing system of government. So there's stuff to be really interested in and proud of.
Absolutely. A couple of the things that I think people are particularly proud of and are constantly referred to these days are proportional representation and compulsory voting. Now, as I understand it, those things aren't actually mentioned in the Constitution document, but you write about them as if they're part of our constitutional system. Could you explain what their origins are and what you mean by this broader sense of a constitutional system?
Well, on the origins, I think for morning radio, I just have to ask the readers to go and have a close look because there's a good history in there. But basically it came about in, you know, early, mid 20th century through legislative reform. And one of the things we say in the book is we often talk about the Constitution as if it's just that written document enacted in 1901, but really we have a multidimensional Constitution which comprises the text of that document but also important statutes, important High Court decisions, legislative policy and practice that becomes convention or executive, you know, practice that becomes convention. So four things: convention, decisions of the court, legislation and the text all make up our Constitution. And, you know, Mabo, we say, in the Constitution in that broader sense, the Sex Discrimination Act in that Constitution in the broader sense, but so too our electoral system. So compulsory voting and preferential voting are some of our greatest and most important features of a resilient democracy, along with the AEC and the independent electoral system. But they are constitutional in the sense of being important, enduring, and pretty politically immune from being tinkered with, which is what we think makes a constitution. And when you see it in that broad sense, we have a much more flexible but also rich and interesting constitution, and one that the people and our representatives play a pretty big role in shaping.
Yeah, so that's the broader constitutional system. You also talk about constitutional values. So what are constitutional values, and are they something that we have in Australia?
So when you go to Kenya or South Africa or a lot of constitutions around the world, you pick up the document and it starts with a list of values. And, you know, that has a virtue in helping shape each generation, not just migrant Australians, but young people would know more clearly what our values are. When Minister Clare this week said, oh, we need to teach more Aussie values in civics and citizenship, they had to sort of scramble to come up with the list. And one of the things that we say in the book is there is a list. It's not written at the top in, you know, bold ink, but if you look at the tradition, if you look at the text, if you look at the multidimensional constitution, there are lots of important values: democracy, the rule of law. But we also highlight equality, freedom and social solidarity as things we say you can definitely find strong support for in our system and in our tradition. And we think as we go forward and grapple with the hard issues, the issues like protest or campaign finance, we should be drawing on those three values: equality, freedom, social solidarity.
We've had a couple of interesting texts from listeners. Joe from Curtin in the ACT says, my great-grandfather was an Indigenous man born in 1856, not invited to be included in the writing of the Constitution. He regards that as the largest issue of the Australian Constitution. Professor Ros Dixon, would you agree with that?
Totally, absolutely, 100%, Joe. And it's the great stain on our tradition, which the Voice referendum failed to rectify. But one of the things we're trying to do is emphasise that not all is lost for change, because both court cases like Mabo or Love or Yunupingu, or legislative change like the Racial Discrimination Act and aspects of the Native Title Act that were positive rather than regressive, are there. And, you know, a voice or similar form of reform could be enacted via legislation as part of this broader system that we have in our multidimensional constitution. So absolutely yes, and reform is needed, but it could take a lot of different paths.
And Emma from Canberra texts in to say that for 10 years her parents drove around Australia in a camper van doing talks in libraries to increase understanding of the Constitution. On the back of the camper van was written a cup of tea and a slice of Constitution. So I reckon you're pretty solid chance of a sale there, Ross.
Well, I think I need Emma's parents to join the movement. That's really devoted, and thank you, Emma, and your parents for all the hard work.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, Emma's family's on the case, but what are you and your co-author hoping to achieve by this book? Who do you want to read it?
Well, everyone who doesn't know a lot about our system and who's curious, constitution curious, but also frustrated, the sense of like, well, I don't feel the system's quite working for us. How can we make it better? You know, this is meant to be a roadmap for how you make change. I'm very committed to high school civics education, to finding better ways of doing it at TAFE and uni, and having a broader conversation with the community. Look, this is not going to be a bestseller, but if it helps a few people understand better the avenues that they have available to make their society, you know, fairer, more inclusive, reflect their values, that's, you know, success. And we're definitely talking to, you know, people listening to the radio or tuning in, but also hoping to reach kids. And we've done a lot of work at the Resilient Democracy Lab already on that, and we're going to be doing more in the coming year and years to come.
And just finally, Rosalind, I know you're the Anthony Mason Professor of Law. I couldn't help but notice that you do say in the book that few doubt the correctness of Sir Anthony Mason's advice to the Governor General in 1975. But I wondered, and I don't know if you're allowed to make these comments about Anthony Mason, given your position, but whether you'd agree with the former Chief Justice Robert French that what Sir Garfield Barwick did, and I think by implication Anthony Mason in 1975 advising the Governor General, that that would simply never be repeated today?
Look, I think, you know, there's the dismissal lives large in the imagination of a generation, and everyone has a big stake in it. I mean, my view is the substance of the advice, which is that Whitlam needed a warning, he needed the opportunity to rectify the lack of supply before any action to dismiss was taken. I believe that's correct, and Sir Anthony advised that. I think, you know, in general, I would not be in favour of High Court judges giving that advice if there was a plausible alternative source of advice. If it was up to me, the Governor General would have their own direct senior legal advisor for that very purpose. I'm not willing to say it was wrong. I am willing to say it wasn't ideal. Sir Anthony's a good friend of mine, and I've told him that directly.
And it's fair to say that the position you've just described is also what Robert French, former Chief Justice, thinks should be the case, although there's no particular sign of those changes on the horizon. But Rosalind, it's been great discussing the Aussie Constitution with you. Thank you so much for joining
us
on Sunday Extra.
Thanks, Julian.
And that's Rosalind Dixon, Anthony Mason Professor and Scienta Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales, and along with co-author William Partlett, they have written The People's Guide to the Australian Constitution. It's 31 minutes past eight, and just to let all our listeners know that the interview that we conducted at the beginning of the show about the evolving situation in the Middle East with Bilal Saab is now available on ABC Listen, as is another interview that we weren't able to air on the radio about the moves in the Israeli parliament to broaden the scope of the death penalty in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Both those stories now available on ABC Listen.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.